Is there an apocalypse? Maybe not. Jonathan Zapp, our special guest, and we'll be back with him and more on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Jonathan Zapp. Jonathan, let's get back to your analogy of Space Odyssey. Go ahead.
Okay. We were kind of a cliffhanger. And what's happened is that David Bowman, the astronaut, is landing on what looks like a monolith, but it's actually a stargate, an interdimensional corridor. It's called a stargate in the book. And he's basically crossing the event horizon. And it is passing through this tunnel. He is experiencing both the death of his old form, which is terrifying to him, and his mind is being blown by what he's seeing and so forth, but it is also a quantum evolutionary event. And here's where it really gets interesting. As he is passing through this tunnel, it is described exactly the way the tunnels are described in Life After Life that didn't come out till 7 years later. Here's what Bowman, here's what it says in 2000.
And who had that vision? Kubrick? Or
well, it was
Clark.
A collaboration. It really originally came from a story that Clark wrote.
Right.
And I have to say it was a little bit more Clark, because another of the greatest visions of the singularity archetype is Childhood's End. So I would say it's a little bit more him, but Clark. But Kubrick was such a genius that, you know, the two just, it was a melding,
sure,
of geniuses that does not happen very often. And so here's what Bowman experiences crossing the event horizon. It's just a couple of sentences. The star field was expanding as if it was rushing toward him at an inconceivable speed. The expansion was nonlinear. The stars at the center hardly seemed to move, while those toward the edge accelerated more and more swiftly until they became streaks of light just before they vanished from view. Now, here's somebody who had a near-death experience, describing their experience to Dr. Kenneth Ring. The blackness began to erupt into a myriad of stars, and I felt as if I were at the center of the universe with a complete panoramic view in all directions. The next instant, I began to feel a forward surge of movement. The stars seemed to fly past me so rapidly that they formed a tunnel around me. And people will frequently describe going through the tunnel that it felt like they were traveling at the speed of light. Now, even more amazing, as he's going through the tunnel, he's having a life review. Now, once again, remember, life review was not even coined until 7 years later. Here's what he experiences. The springs of memory were being trapped. In controlled recollections, he was reliving the past, and not only vision, but all the sense impressions and all the emotions he had felt at the time were racing past more and more swiftly. His life was unreeling like a tape recorder playing back at an ever-increasing speed. And even as he relived these events, he knew that all was indeed well. He was retrogressing down the corridors of time, being drained of knowledge and experience as he swept back toward his childhood. But nothing was being lost. All that he had ever been at every moment of his life was being transferred to safer keeping. Even as one David Bowman ceased to exist, another became immortal. Now, remember that Clark is a famous atheist, and he's describing this.
But it doesn't sound that way, does it?
Exactly. Here's what somebody having a near-death experience describes, just a couple sentences. It's like a picture runs in front of your eyes. It seems like pictures of your life just flow in front of your eyes. The things you used to do when you were small, it was like a movie camera running across your eyes in a matter of a second or two. So basically, here we have an atheist, a science fiction writer, an astrophysicist, Arthur C. Clarke. But what he's describing is what people who have near-death experiences describe. It's also so much like what the people who had these dreams I described, one of whom was described as a simple Protestant woman. This is what happens with an archetype, is that it doesn't matter who you are or what your belief system is, you will have these parallel encounters, just like the near-death experience has these classic stages, and people, whether they are believers, whether they are atheists, whatever they happen to be, they will have parallel experiences in any period, in any culture.
And are you saying that whatever might be on the other side, it's the same whether you're dead or alive?
Well, what's on the other side may be extremely various. And remember that, you know, a substantial minority percentage of people who have near-death experiences will experience a hellish realm, from some of the reports that we get from a pioneer out-of-body experiencer like Monroe, you know, he would describe many different realms. There isn't necessarily one thing across the event horizon. There may be many different things, and what the mystics and religious seers and people from all kinds of different esoteric traditions have said is that basically what you are going to experience once you cross the event horizon depends a lot on what you're doing right now and who you are right now and your consciousness at the moment when you cross. And I think the same is also true for the human species. I don't think that our future as a species or as individuals is fully formed. If it were, we would not have free will. I think some aspects of the future are formed, like the fact that the individual is destined to die, that the species is destined to come to an end or transform in an unimaginable way. Mm-hmm. I think that is pre-structured. But the meaning of someone's death may have to do with the choices that they make right now. And that may affect even the timing of it, you know, based on the diet I choose to eat, the risks I choose to take. That may even control the timing, or it may not. There could be some big geological event that takes out everybody in the community. But who we are as a species, as individuals, may have a lot to do with what we experience as we cross the event horizon. So there's a lot of implications in the singularity archetype for living a good life now.
How come then we have so much evil, Jonathan?
How come we have so much
evil?
Evil. Good question. And this relates to the singularity archetype too, because it also has a dark side. Here's one way I think about it is, you know, and when novelty accelerates, the outer edge of light and the outer edge of dark both must intensify. And here's why. Let's do a little thought experiment. If I were to put you in a position of being God, now you would be in that position if, for example, I said, write a novel, George, about a young person who's going to develop spiritually. Now, if you gave that person the perfect job, the perfect relationship, the economy where they lived was perfect, prosperous, their boss loved them, they had no health problems, this is going to be the world's most boring novel, and they're not really going to develop. If you think about The Lord of the Rings, which is a story about a whole crossing the event horizon from one era to another, has a lot of parallels to the present time. If you had The Lord of the Rings with no Sauron or Saruman or Ringwraiths or orcs, you'd basically have hobbits going out on dates with other hobbits. It'd be fun for them, but it'd be very boring. It'd be very stagnant. So we need some degree of darkness for there to be development.
Balance?
Balance, and also that we need shocks to grow. Biologists call it punctuated equilibrium. If it wasn't for the last giant asteroid that hit, apparently, we would still be living in a world of dinosaurs. The devastation caused by that last asteroid was the opportunity for mammals to step into the breach. So biological systems are conservative. They try and achieve homeostasis, a dialed-in equilibrium. And in order to change, and so they don't seek out change. Most of the mutagenic things, like radiation, are destructive. So they try and, like, kind of keep things on an even keel. And the human psyche, as both Freud and Jung recognized, is also like that. It's better the devil I know than the devil I don't know. And so to get change, you need shock. And that's why in most traditional societies, they had rites of initiation, where, for example, they'd give somebody an ordeal poison, where you would first feel like you're dying, then you'd be in such pain you would beg for death, but then you'd get all better. But the intense shock of that would kind of, if you got through it, would kind of boost you to another level. What happens when shock appears is there's kind of a splitting two ways. In chaos math, I think they call it a bifurcation. Things can go higher or lower. Like the Dylan lyric, he who's not busy being born is busy dying. So when a shock comes in an individual's life, maybe they have a car accident, they can get depressed, their life can dwindle and spiral downward, or it could be the thing that shocks them out of egoism and selfishness, and they go to a higher level. And so that's kind of why we need evil, is because we need to stir things up. And I'm not saying that's an answer for every form of evil and all the suffering, because some of it is just an irreducible mystery. And when you watch a child dying of AIDS or something, you don't want to try and explain it away conveniently. But certainly we can see that there would not be development or evolution without an adversary.
All right, let's bring this back to the apocalypse for a moment here,
okay.
Jonathan. In the book of Revelation, at the back of the Bible,
right,
it talks about all these horrendous things that will occur before things get better, this years of tribulation and everything else. That, to me, is prophecy. Will that come true?
Well, I mean, there's one Jungian who's given the revelations and interpretation that it's all about, you know, the ego's shock as it evolves into the self, and you can interpret it in a symbolic way. I personally, I was hoping you wouldn't bring revelations back up. I mean, I don't want to offend anybody, but
yeah, but it's there. It's in black and white.
There. It's a document that, to be frank, has a high body count associated with it, because apocalypticism is an addiction, and an addiction is a form of craziness. And one definition of craziness is you keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Nothing in human enterprise that I can think of, even dieting and romance, doesn't compare with the failure rate of prophecy. And yet people keep coming back to it again and again. And remember that quote, I think it was in Matthew, I can look that up. Where they say, you know, this is going to, there are people among you right now that, you know, will not die. So basically, this is 2,000 years wrong and counting. And, you know, I'm kind of in sympathy with some of the early church fathers that lobbied to keep revelations out of the Bible. They saw it as a dangerous document. And year after year, it continues to prove out to be that. We see suicide cults associated with it. It is like a magnet for people that want to reach for that addiction of apocalypticism.
Yet a lot of people believe this. Why?
Because
not just those people who, you know, are whacked out, you know,
right.
They kill
good
themselves
people.
Hoping
people.
To get to heaven or something.
Right, exactly. Good people believe it because we need a way of explaining the unexplainable, and we need a way of putting the drama of life into a perspective in which we feel selected for a special destiny, where we feel it is all leading to a denouement, and apocalypticism and things like revelations are a magnet for those kind of feelings. And people will always feel that something like that is imminent.
Let's take a few calls here. We'll go to our first-time caller, Roman, in San Francisco, California. Hi, Roman. Thanks for calling.
Hey, George. Hey, Mr. Zapp.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm kind of scared about the whole San Andreas fault, like having a big eruption again, like, you know, how in 1989,
well,
right?
That could happen.
Sure.
And is it really possible how the West Coast can go entirely into the ocean?
Well, you know, you're not a geologist, Jonathan. I'm not a geologist at all. But as you were saying, the lady who died basically predicted that a part of California would chip off and fall into the ocean. So, I don't know.
And eventually, something like that absolutely will happen. I mean, we only have to look at the outline of the continents to see that they were once together and imagine what kind of forces it took to split them off. And these things will happen, but the message from the singularity archetype is that what looks like the worst thing in the world is actually what may be exactly what's necessary to create a quantum evolutionary jump. And that's true for the species, and it's true for the life of the individual. So when the worst thing happens, just remember that might actually be the moment of opportunity.
You know, I used to, as a boy, I was worried all the time when our teacher told us that the sun eventually would burn out. And even though he talked about it in terms of billions of years, to me it seemed like it would be tomorrow.
Right.
And I panicked as a little kid. It was very easy for me.
Exactly. And I had very parallel feelings, George. I had a terrible fear of death. What really cured it for me was not reading about near-death experience. It was some of my own personal out-of-body experiences. And even though this would have no scientific validity, since it's a very subjective, anecdotal kind of thing, the experience, the felt experience of being outside your physical body and being incredibly enhanced by that, altered my fear of death just vanished like, a boogeyman on a movie screen when the bright light of sunlight, you know, falls upon it.
Sure.
And I think that there's a very hopeful message in some of the research that's undergoing right now under scientific auspices in the field of parapsychology. some of the work of Dean Radin.
Yeah, great work too.
Some of the amazing near-death experience researchers that you've had on the show, like Pim van Lommel, the Dutch cardiologist, mm-hmm. who wrote an amazing book and did studies that were featured in the journal Lancet, a peer-reviewed journal. And they really show, I think, incontrovertibly at this point, the survival of consciousness, the existence of consciousness without a functioning brain. And I go into some of this in great depth in the book, like the Pam Reynolds case. Art Bell interviewed her years ago.
A long time ago.
There was a BBC documentary about near-death experience. It's amazing. People can watch it for free on YouTube, and it gets into the Pam Reynolds case. These things, just the position of neurological materialism that you hear constantly, that consciousness is nothing but a secondary effect of biochemical process in the brain. People have been brought up to believe that, and it's very depressing, and it's actually not true. We have evidence that you know, completely contradicts that theory that has never been proven. And it really depresses people. And I'll give you a specific example. When I worked in an alternative school years ago.
And what's an alternative school?
It's a school for like kids that are not fitting into the regular high school. Sometimes there's a very creative kid. Sometimes they're kids that are just really acting out and need some special attention.
Troubled kids?
Exactly.
Okay.
And one of them was, we'll call Mark, was 15 years old and was people thought I was good at working with kids. They kind of assigned him to me. He was suicidal, and he was in deep trouble. And working with him, we eventually traced back when he really suddenly became deeply depressed. It was when he was watching a documentary that showed some kind of brain surgery going on, and they had sort of labeled portions of the person's brain and seemed to be touching it with a probe, and the person's arm would move.
Mm-hmm.
And what he got from seeing that was that we were just, to use the name of a popular punk band, that we were just meat puppets, that we were just, the brain was like a circuit board. Basically, he internalized, without even hearing it spelled out, the philosophy of neurological materialism, and it was devastating to him. And it should be devastating, you know, if that's all we are. But we now, anyone willing to do the research, can satisfy themselves, no matter how scrupulously scientific and skeptical they are, and I encourage that stance, that consciousness does not depend on a body.
No, we're much more than that. You know
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
You know, Jonathan, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back in just a moment. More phone calls, more discussion with Jonathan Zapp as we talk about his latest work, Crossing the Event Horizon. He's also got a couple DVDs out there. Better, you can go straight to his website, which is linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you right now. Don't forget, Fast Blast is open as well. And also, a little thanks for those of you continuing to support Children International. Thank you so much for what you're doing. We're still looking for 97 more sponsorships to go at 75 cents a day for a one-year commitment. If you can afford it during these tough times, I'd appreciate it. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Indeed, with our special guest tonight, Jonathan Zapp. And we'll be back with more as we talk about the apocalypse on Coast to Coast AM. Jonathan, how does this, if at all, tie into the Mayan calendar 2012 end date?
Okay, well, in several different ways, and there's a long document on my website called Carnival 2012, a psychological study of the 2012 phenomenon, right, and the 22 pitfalls and blind spots of esoteric research that gets into this in depth. But it has to do with that projection thing again. Now, there is something very interesting and valid about that date that my friend and colleague John Major Jenkins, who you've talked to a number of times, has worked on in some of his seminal books like Galactic Alignment, The 2012 Story, Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. But just for a quick dose of sanity, one is that the Mayan calendar does not end. Like all calendars, it's perpetual. A big cycle rolls over. Our calendar didn't end in the year 2000. One cycle ends, another begins. So that's number one, because there's a lot of ill-informed material out there. Another is when you hear people talk about Mayan prophecy. Well, there is no Mayan prophecy that anybody has ever discovered about 2012, not one single sentence. All we have is a few hundred-year-old document called the Popol Vuh that talks about cycle endings in general. And the news there is not grim. It's not about disaster. It's about, you know, a turning point and going from one cycle to another, and that there can be a renewal and a rebirth, though there might be some tough things getting there. So basically, 2012 becomes a projection screen that people, it's a conveniently close date, and people can project onto it their apocalypticism that they inherited probably from, you know, an Abrahamic faith, not anything Mayan, and use that as a thing to glom onto. And I think it's actually the whole Carnival 2012 thing, I think, is a little bit on decline because now the date is a little bit inconveniently close. We saw most of the 2012 products come out a couple of years ago, like the movie, the Roland Emmerich movie and so forth. But now people are sensing like, hey, you know, I'm going to get Y2K'd by this. And I'm going to start to back away from this now because it would be better if it was a few years out and we could kind of gin it up for, you know, quite a bit more. Now, the valid aspect of 2012 is that is the cycle shift and what the Mayans say about the cycle shift. And Aldous Huxley wrote about something called the perennial philosophy. It's a philosophy that we find in many different cultures, the Western alchemists, the Maya, the Egyptians, the Hindus, about cycle shifts. And most of these systems would see four great ages, a dark age, and the Hindus called it the Kali Yuga, and then there'd be a turning point to a new golden age where things would get as dark, bad as they can, and then they would start to get better. Now, if you go with that, and it is at least supported by a number of different cultures, then 2012, which has a certain, very particular kind of galactic alignment, an optical galactic alignment associated with it, would mark that turning point. But as John Major Jenkins described it, it'd be a period of decades, not like a certain turning on the dime type of thing. And it would represent a turning point toward an age of enlightenment. And to some extent, even though it doesn't seem like it from the headlines, we're actually experiencing that, I believe. We are experiencing this enlightenment, even though the newspaper headlines seem like just the opposite. Like right now, and my friend Rob Bresgeny, who's written a wonderful book called Pronoia, mm-hmm. The Opposite of Paranoia, has written a lot about this. You know, if reading the headlines, you'd think the world is just being torn apart by war. But actually, we have right now the lowest per capita war death rate that has probably existed in thousands of years. It's terrible, even one casualty, but the numbers are actually quite small with a 6.5 billion population. And actually, contrary to what some people might assume, an indigenous rainforest tribe, according to an anthropologist who's got an excellent lecture on TED.com, if you were growing up in a indigenous rainforest tribe, you would have a far greater per capita war death rate than even the 20th century.
It's probably 50%.
Right, because the young men had such a high probability of being killed in a skirmish with another tribe. So we are getting less violent. Rates of violence in this country are down dramatically. When I was growing up in New York City, there were 2,000 murders a year. Now there's 400. And another thing that we see is even physically and technologically, there's an enlightening going on. Like during the 1990s, it was reported that the gross national product doubled in value, but its physical weight, tripled in value, its physical weight halved because we were producing less pig iron and steel and things like that, and more pixels and more zeros and ones as intellectual property.
See, I would say, though, Jonathan, that as the overall population seems to get more tuned in with living and consciousness and crime goes down, I think the power brokers are getting worse.
Well, this is entirely possible because one classic thing that we see is that when there is improvement in one area, then the people who are connected to the regressive past get exacerbated and get worse. And I think we see this with Islamic fundamentalism, where they get freaked out when they see women gaining their rights throughout the world. So then they crack down even harsher on the number of women who are victims of stove burnings and honor burnings is just
crazy. They can't even drive cars.
Exactly. They're incredibly repressed. I have a friend who works on this issue. I used to work with his nonprofit just about women who are being oppressed by Islamic fundamentalism. So what happens is when you have improvements in one area, those that want to stay in the past will get far worse. So once, and we see this with a lot of the myths about the singularity archetype, where a new mutant is created, and now the old power structure, the old military-industrial complex gets worried and attacks. Like, for example, in the Japanese anime classic Akira. Mutants are born, and they're a threat to the whole paramilitary corporate structure, and they want to use them for their own purposes. So this comes up constantly with the singularity archetype, is that the changes threaten the old system, and people will have a kind of immunological response. They will take something new. It looks like an antibody. It looks like a foreign invader, like, for example, the Disney movie Powder, about a young mutant, you know, who's been born because his mother was struck with lightning, and he has parapsychological powers and so forth, and he's more intelligent and sensitive and empathic and a very good person. But the people in the community won't want to burn him at the stake because he represents something new and different. And so you're absolutely right that, you know, power structures are getting worried. And it's like Princess Leia said to Darth Vader, you know, Darth, the more you tighten your grasp, the more star systems will slip through your fingers. And that's what's really going on and has them worried.
All right, let's take some more calls for you. Chaz in Las Vegas, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Chaz.
Hey, what's going on, George?
Hi, good to have you with us.
Big fan of you, and I lived in Memphis for a long time and visit St. Louis quite often. But, forgive me if I'm repeating prior question, but Jungian psychology was created by Carl Jung, if I'm correct, and his original experimentation was based on fantasy and the unconscious mind. However, he couldn't accept Sigmund Freud's view on the nature of unconsciousness. I'm confused as how fantasy and the unconscious mind can predict apocalyptic events when even in today's time we have actually began to ignore everything around us, whether it be conscious or unconscious.
All right, go ahead.
Good question. And actually, Jung succeeded in prophecy, even though it's a very rare thing, and he did it following his classic methods. One of the things that happened to Jung, he was working as an analyst in the Weimar Republic, pre-World War II Germany, and he noticed a peculiar thing. His educated German patients were all dreaming of Wotan, a Germanic god of war and mayhem, and he actually wrote about this. He called it Wotanism, and he was able to predict from that he described it as a blonde beast would emerge from Germany, that a warlike spirit in the German people was going to erupt and wreak havoc. And so by looking at the fantasies, he was able to make a correct prophecy. And the modern person growing up in a materialist society, when they have a fantasy or something flits through their mind, they're like, oh, that's a mere nothing. It doesn't mean anything. But no, as Jung pointed out, it's a factual experience. It's a fact that you thought of that one little bit of nonsense and nothing other. And that occurrence in your psyche of a fantasy, a dream, whatever it is, mean something. And if we were to follow its roots, we would learn things about the structure of what's going on. And remember that war, environmental pollution, conflict, the economy, these are all 100% psychological products. So if we're able to penetrate into the psyche and see the source of these things, we're able to learn about what's going on. And one of the best sources of information is dreams, because they're often an access right into the collective unconscious.
Absolutely, they're a window to the conscious world, unconscious world as well. What do you mean by singularity when you talk about singularity archetype?
Right, and obviously I'm using the word in a somewhat more traditional sense, not in the sense that it means in mathematics or, you know, related to black holes, but it is an event that it is a complete break with the earlier pattern. It's a complete anomaly. It reminds me of the J.B.S. Haldane statement, reality is not only stranger than you think, it's stranger than you can think. So the singularity is the stranger than you can think moment that breaks you out of everything you've taken for granted in the past.
Next up, we go to east of the Rockies. Reuben is in Manhattan, New York. Hey, Reuben.
Hey, how you doing? Hey,
okay.
George. Hey, Jonathan. Good morning to you guys.
You too.
I just wanted to comment on something Jonathan said about the event horizon. I mean, I have my own theory of that, and it's more or less the same thing. I've always felt that way, which you explained earlier, how who you are here will determine who you become when you reach the next level. I believe there's many different levels of good and bad. Some people, like, you know, when they make references to demons or angelic beings, well, I believe who you are here will determine that, what you will become. You know, if you're a really bad person and you want to destroy and you enjoy seeing people getting hurt and killed, then you'll go more towards that side. And eventually your spirit, who you are, who we are, will originally metamorph into that demon. But if you are nice and you're good of heart and you're naturally a nice person, then you will, you know, continue to go up. And you will eventually become, you know, this a divine being of the astral plane. I that's like just one of my theories that I've had.
Well, the way I think of it, and I express this throughout my Zap Oracle, which is really a spiritual tool about living a good life now, is I always remind people to, and some of this sounds morbid, to me it's very life-affirming, to do what they will remember well on their deathbed. And one of the images on the Coast website that I didn't mention is one of the final scenes in 2001, where we see a profoundly old man lying in a bed. He's lying in his deathbed. And David Bowman, the astronaut, has had these out-of-body experiences where he sees himself from a remote point of view. He sees himself as an older guy, then he becomes that older guy. Then the older guy sees this almost dead person lying on their deathbed, and then he becomes that person. And then in that image, you see this extremely old man reaching up with his hand, and it looks very much like the gesture of Adam reaching toward God in the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel by Michelangelo. And at the foot of the bed, we see a black monolith. And that black monolith is both a stargate and a tombstone. So basically, this is what we are heading toward in our lives. We are all hurtling toward a guaranteed event horizon, and I think that's a wonderful thing. And instead of trying to bring it closer in a fantasy way through end times and trying to predict the end, we need to live very meaningful lives now so that when we get to that stargate / tombstone, we are ready. And that's really a key message I like to communicate to people.
Okay, we go now to a wild card line, Dubuque, Iowa. Let's go to you, Janet, on Coast to Coast. Hi, Janet.
Hey, George. Hey, Jonathan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I find it interesting, Jonathan, that you mentioned projection, because I've been doing a great deal of study in the Bible lately, and I'm finding it kind of amusing when people name dates when the planet's going to end.
Right.
One of the most interesting things, though, I think people got confused, those Left Behind books.
Right.
When it talks about two people reaping and one gets taken, we're talking about Noah's flood. And people tend to latch on to things like that and say, I'm going to be at work and I'm going to be at the deep fryer and then it's just going to be the fries, you know? basically, prophecy's really only been studied by, you know, mainline Christian churches for like the last half a century. They didn't touch it. For instance, talking about God's elect, the Jews, having three diaspora, some people thought that and three returns. Many people thought, oh, when Israel came into being in 48, there's your third return. But in fact, the promised land is 300,000 square miles, and there are those who would say that's not a return yet. So I find it interesting because people do tend to project on things like that, and unfortunately, they tend to do it in a very negative way, you know? At least it doesn't usually catch my attention when someone says, oh, by the way, the Christian church won't be in the Great Tribulation. Okay. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, people assume it's going to be horrible and the Earth's going to blow up. And that's not even what that prophecy says.
Exactly. And so, this is why people should you know, take pause before they invest too much in these things, because other Christians reading the same document are coming up with completely different conclusions. So when people say it's the word of God, but actually these words can be interpreted many different ways. So don't, you know, be very cautious and humble before you invest in the way that one preacher or one new prophet is saying to interpret those words, because other people have come up with very different results. And what I would trust is serious biblical scholars, Jewish, Christian, whatever. When you read what they say, and when people go to seminary, I know Ian has talked about this, they're often rather shocked because they sort of think it'll be a continuation of Sunday school and they'll hear all their favorite interpretations confirmed. When people go to seminaries and they're dealing with real biblical scholarship and archaeology, they're a little bit taken aback because they start to realize how tenuous these different interpretations are. And I would go with real high quality biblical scholarship in archaeology if you really want to study that.
You had said that you're really not that concerned about end times, that you know, you live every day as if it's your last, like I try to. What would you tell people, though, who are panicking about these things?
Well, one thing I would tell them is realize if you look at the book of Job, for example, whatever they're experiencing, it's something that everybody has experienced. You know, you're not the only one. It's like there's some kind of Buddhist meditation where you pray for healing and compassion for yourself and for all other sentient beings. So, you know, look to often the best way out of your own panic is it's very egocentric. It's very internal considering, poor me, what's going to happen to me? Take that energy and go out and help somebody less fortunate. Practice external considering. See if you can help somebody who's in a worse state than you are, and you find yourself pulled out of that panic. A lot of my neurotic anxieties were cured by being a school teacher. You know, when you have 30 high-energy kids in a room, there's just no room for that internal craziness to go on. You're forced out of yourself, and I think that's a good thing for people.
Well, I think so, too. Jonathan, tell us again about the download that's available on your website.
Yeah, it's a free PDF of the first 40 pages or so of the book, and there's also a free podcast of the beginning of the book. It's kind of a self-contained unit, and the book will be coming out later this summer.
Okay, we're at the top of the hour. We'll be back with a final hour of phone calls with Jonathan Zapp as we talk about the apocalypse and also his book, which is dealing with singularity archetype. It's called Crossing the Event Horizon. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And if you need to email me, George@coast2to coasttocoastam.com.